So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance of
the roots of a tree. Because you can't heat the roots of a tree and not heat the tree. You can't heat your origin and not end up heating yourself.
I point these things out so that you and I will know.
But in the streets, we remember his name. A voice for justice, standing through pain. They try to silence, but he still speaks. In every heart, the truth he seeks. Malcolm X.
Prince.
Malcolm X,
our guiding light.
Malcolm X,
our fierce defense. Our brother.
Through the struggle, we'll carry your name. In your honor, we bring about change. Malcolm united us, brought us back home to the roots of our people, no longer alone. From the streets of Harlem to Africa's land, he showed us the power of a righteous stance. Malcolm X,
our shining prince.
Malcolm X,
our guiding light.
Malcolm X,
our fierce defense. Our brother.
Through the struggle, we'll carry your name. In your honor, we bring about change. Your words still echo loud and clear in our hearts. You're always near. Oh, Malcolm X, your fight's not done. We carry the torch one by one. Oh, Malcolm X,
our shining prince.
In Malcolm X,
our guiding light.
Malcolm X, the struggle will carry your name. In your honor, we bring about change.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We want to celebrate the birthday of El-Haj Malik Shabazz, better known as Malcolm X. Some people knew him as Detroit Red. We have with us somebody who knew the brother, who's been involved in his life before and after. He's prolific in his own right. He's a journalist. Many of us know him for his writings in the Amsterdam News. I did not realize how many books you actually have. This is our guest, Herb Boyd. You know, I knew a couple, but when I was looking, I was like, okay, there's one on Sugar Ray Robinson. There's one on Emmett Till. There's, you know, there's James Baldwin. So I lost count after about 10, you know. But the one that we're focusing on, at least we want to draw from, is the one that you edited, which is Malcolm X's diaries. And I think that's something that a lot of people aren't fully familiar with. And we're glad to have you so that you can put some perspective on both his diaries and just him as a human being, especially at these times. So,
Oh, I welcome that opportunity. Thanks for having me, Davey. One of the things about some clarification on my publications, first of all, I guess I'm nearing 30, but you have to understand that there's a difference between the complete authoring of a book and an editing, an anthology in particular. And I've edited, I guess, at least half of those books have been edited anthologies, as opposed to me being the sole author of.
Okay.
Obviously, with the Sugar Ray Robinson and with James Baldwin, the two that you mentioned, those were mine completely.
Right.
And the others, I either, like you take the Odyssey of Black Men in America, I did with one of your friends out there, Robert Allen.
Okay.
So that was a massive anthology that followed up on what Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones did with Larry Neal on Black Fire. So again, that was a collection of writings that included Black men and Black women. So anyway, that's the distinction there in terms of clarification on the various books. I take responsibility for all of the errors and error.
I hear you on that. Well, okay. I mean, there's very few errors, I'm sure. Maybe one or two, you know.
Some typos here, right?
Yeah, some typos. But with that being said, editing the diaries of Malcolm X is a monumental task. And I would only imagine that you have to know somebody so that you don't overlook the nuances, the subtleties. I know when I've written, people who don't know me have taken things out that are absolutely important. You know, as a writer, I feel it's always important to look at things through a historical lens. And I've written for papers and come back and they just gave, like, you know, some plain old facts. It's like, oh, you just had a bunch of history. No, that history was the key part of who I am. You know what I'm saying? And so with the Diary of Malcolm, talk a little bit about that book and what it took to edit it down and what we needed to really glean, because I feel like you captured a lot of things that we heard about Malcolm but didn't really get to know or fully appreciate, especially since it was in the latter part of his life.
Indeed. It's a tribal diary, essentially, capturing the several months of 1964 and a little bit of 1965 before his assassination and his travel abroad. And in doing so, Davey, I mean, he, from Ghana to Tanzania and all of the African countries in between, including Algeria and Morocco, and of course in Europe, France, and London, and in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. I mean, so he was an intrepid adventurer, you might say, at that point, but at the same time, kind of a minister without portfolio.
Right.
And it's a challenge, just getting your bags packed, getting your shot record, getting your visa, and getting your passport in order. That's a task enough for an individual to travel, and then get your hotel arrangements and your flight. I mean, all of those things he had to do.
And this is before computers. There was no computers in 1964
My goodness.
No internet, no Expedia, no travel lodge.
It was a challenge. And not having any, what you might call staff.
Right.
Because, you know, he's meeting with at least seven major political leaders in these two trips that he made. You have to have some preparation for that. Malcolm was a quick study. He was a quick study. Dr. John Henry Clark said that Malcolm was the best student he ever had. And I say, oh, I guess that throws us all into the into the background, you know. But we welcome that because of Malcolm's prodigious research and reading and his understanding and the kind of ideological Black nationalist, Pan-Africanist outlet that he had. So we concede that he was a superb student,
right,
and an observer, and able to meet with the Kwame Nkrumahs and the Julius Nyereres and the Tom Mboyas and the Nasser and these individuals, these world leaders out there, and sit down with them and have a very, very solid conversation about world politics.
Right.
That was his province. And he was growing in this, Davey. I mean, you have to just understand his background, as many of us do, coming out the incarceration, the whole, as a young person in the underground economy, and dealing with all kind of individuals in the nightlife, you know, the club owners, the jazz musicians, the activists of that time, particularly in Detroit, when he hooked up with the members of the Republic of New Africa and the Shrine of the Black Madonna with Albert Clegg, Gerald Moji. So all of this is taken in the context in a cumulative way and giving him some kind of perspective, informing him about not only domestic affairs, but foreign relations. So,
right.
So all of that, we understand that this travel abroad is going to be nonetheless a challenging one, because he doesn't have anyone preparing any kind of, here's a list of items, you know, here's the talking points and stuff, like you're gonna be meeting with this here with Nasser, and you gotta be prepared for that. Are you in Saudi Arabia getting ready to go to make the Hajj to Mecca, right, and to Medina? All of these are challenging things, but he never missed a moment. It's amazing. You look at the diary each day, and you're talking about entries across two long trips in several months, particularly in the Middle East, North Africa. And he documents, and he knew he was writing for posterity. That seems to be clear.
Right.
And it's just like, you random jot down, here's what happened, blah, 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 individuals I met, and these things were discussed. Malcolm knew he was a person of history.
That's the sense that I get. Let's focus on a couple of things that stand out, not just in the journals, but what we kind of casually say about Malcolm, but it was more than obvious that he was dead serious. Africa is a place that is divisive in the minds of many. It still has the reputation for a lot of people of being an unsophisticated, dark continent filled with ignorance. And it's complicated by, as Malcolm points out, that there are people that are constantly, you know, whispering in his ear and other people's ears, they don't care about you on that side of the world. So there's that sort of chatter. And so he takes on, to me, almost the role of an ambassador, because he's internationalizing our struggle. And he's also illuminating that Africa is a very sophisticated and very complex, you know, nation to be reckoned with, that it isn't something that's in the backwoods. But you knowing him, what were your conversations like in just reading and what have you? Was he really coming from that standpoint of one that had to kind of shed light and bust down stereotypes?
No doubt about it. He understood the gravity of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
No one can doubt that Malcolm had an understanding of the role he was playing. And I think you put it very well, Davey, in terms of the ambassadorial aspects. As I said, in terms of a secretary or ambassador, you know, this year, he was like a world leader already, you know, in that sense, and prepared to talk to these individuals and raise some very critical issues and questions about what's going on, not only in their country, but in a global context, because he had this Pan-Africanist understanding and background that he gathered. He was like what you call a Pan-Africanist, Black nationalist from an ideological standpoint, but all this is in progress. This is saying that it's a process that he's going through and growing, accumulating information. Can you imagine you being hit as you move from country to country and meeting with these world leaders, and they're talking about their individual issues and trying to contextualize that in terms of, here's this Black man coming from America.
Right.
Who is he? What is he all about? So Malcolm understood exactly some of the reservations and some of the questioning and the kind of subjugations that was going on with who he was, suspicions they may have had of him. At the same time, the suspicions he had of them, each one of them as he moved. And one of the things that jumps out of the diary, that it may be missed by a number of readers, and you talked about the subtleties and the nuances, and there's just a proliferation of those. They just such a prevalence of those in the diary. And that's why I had to begin to bring some of these individuals that he's meeting with during the couple of trips and provide background profiles on them. Even like a Jonas Savimbi, for example, who kind of the notoriety that he gathered in terms of UNITA and doing the whole struggle, you know, in the Southern Africa against the Portuguese regime at that time, you know, and then ultimately in contests, in turmoil, you know, with MPLA and FNLA and some of the other formations, political formations in Southern Africa. But here is Malcolm sitting, this is long before Savimbi is really jumping out there in the late 60s and early 70s, and he's meeting with Malcolm. So people, a reader might say, well, I know of this Savimbi guy, he's meeting with Malcolm, what's going on with that?
Right.
But they have to understand there was a few other individuals that caught my eye. One being that Leo Miles is an individual. Davey, when you go back to reread the diary, pay attention to the meetings, six or seven meetings that he has with a man named Leo Miles.
Okay.
M-I-L-A-S. And it may just fly right past most readers. They don't pay that much attention because Malcolm's is meeting so many individuals.
Yeah. That's the name that definitely flew over my head.
Well, you go back and check it out. What I did, his name jumped out at me because I have read deeply in the whole African liberation struggles in Africa. And particularly the more prominent political formations, as I said earlier, about UNITA, FNLA, and MPLA, and Frelimo out of Mozambique. That's where his name is connected with Frelimo. He was ejected from that organization. This is a political formation, the movement for the popular liberation of Mozambique.
Right. Uh-oh.
Hang on. Are we still there, David?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, good. And let me get back on to launch the meeting thing because it popped off.
Okay.
But anyway, so you can hear me. And so his name jumped up because he had been expelled, you know, from the organization and suspected as being an agent, a government agent.
Wow.
Either of PIDE, of the Portuguese Information Agency, and the covert connection with the CIA. So Malcolm always suspected that he was under surveillance. Obviously, the FBI, and you have the FBI files that Claiborne has pulled together, and Claiborne Carson pulled together FBI files of Malcolm. And there it's an indication how closely under surveillance Malcolm was here in the USA. But once he goes abroad, that the baton of surveillance is passed on to the CIA. This is Central Intelligence Agency. So they pick it up at that point. Malcolm always suspected that he was under surveillance, and rightfully so, he was. But he was paying more attention to the possibility of a white agent and not a black one.
Mm.
So that's where Leo Miles comes into play, because after he was expelled from Frelimo, if in fact the charges and suspicions they had of him being like an agent provocateur inside of their organization, if that holds true, then his next assignment, since he is in East Africa, since he is moving around quite a bit, if that holds true, then he, as a could call a kite back in those days, you know, not exactly a CIA agent, but working in concert, you know, with a station leader of the CIA. In other words, he's just an informant more than anything, because when he's meeting with Malcolm, you say, well, what is his reason for doing that? Why is he meeting whoever? Was he sent to do that? You know, these meetings, he's popping up in four different countries in Malcolm, you know.
Right.
He's learning Malcolm's itinerary. He's almost there before Malcolm and there after Malcolm leaves. So he's got information that's being delivered to him by the agency because they know his itinerary.
Right.
And one of the things about all this, Dave, if you go all the way back to his assassination and meeting with, I had an opportunity to interview one of the undercover agents. Malcolm's organization had been infiltrated.
And
it's been estimated that there was at least three or four.
We're talking about the OUAA organization, not just the Nation of Islam, but Malcolm's very own organization.
Yeah, the Organization of African American Unity, yes.
Yeah.
Because that's one he formed, along with the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. He formed both the, what you call the political and the religious arms. And some, to some extent, people feel that there were some differences between the two, but they would be minor. They were essentially in accord so long as Malcolm was alive. Thereafter, there may have been some dissension. But for the most part, the point is that here he is, you know, with all these undercover agents inside of the OAAU. They had gotten so close and so instrumental in Malcolm's movements. And one man in particular, Gene Roberts, he's no longer with us.
Right.
But he was considered like a bodyguard.
Right.
And he was posted at the podium when Malcolm was gunned down. So we had a chance to, I went with a photographer, I don't know if you know Jules Allen, outstanding photographer, also from out on the coast. Jules and I went up to the Audubon, and we took Gene there and made him recount. And that was published in a couple of publications here in New York, back in Class Magazine in particular.
Right.
They published it, and photographs that Jules took, a number of photographs of Gene Roberts in parts of the Audubon Ballroom, which is in Washington Heights, not in Harlem.
Right, right.
The mistake is often made that the Audubon Ballroom was in Harlem.
168 across from the Presbyterian Hospital.
That's right. That's right. Let's be specific about that. But anyway, because even with, I was reading this morning about the opera X that's going on in Detroit right now, has been revived after almost a generation. And so Telani Davis and Christopher Davis and Anthony Davis, her cousins, is going on now. And I think it'll go to May the 22nd in Detroit. And the opera, even reading the review this morning, New York Times, the guy points out that the reviewer says that the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. I say, well, I'm tired of making that correction.
Right.
Let it go at that. But his review of the opera is pretty mixed. But nonetheless, it's an opportunity to keep Malcolm alive in the same way that we're talking about it. And certainly the diary begins to offer a perspective that broadens the lens, the whole aperture of understanding and contextualizing Malcolm's growing ideological and political perspective, because he was like a work in progress. This is thing when you get to 1965, it's just a plateau.
Right.
He seemed to have the horizon is still receding on us in terms of understanding his growth and development. And the diary gives us some indication of where he's going, because he's meeting with world leaders and jotting down these things. And the CIA is very much aware. In fact, the book I'm working on right now, Davey, for I've been doing it over 10 years now, is accumulating information, not only about Malcolm, but other prominent African-American activists who were under surveillance by the CIA. A lot of work has been done. A couple of scholars have done a good job on that in terms of the FBI surveillance, to say nothing of what Ward right. Churchill and right. Jim Vanderwall have done with agents of repression. But certainly that work is just absolutely crucial.
But the CIA is a whole different ballgame.
It's the whole different right. bag.
Right.
And that needs to be, it's still the difficulties that you have in understanding the surveillance of the FBI pertains also with the CIA, because so much of, I've been in contact with the agency now for a good 10 years and getting stuff. And each time I get stuff from them, both for the most part, if you get, they send you 50 pages, you know, 38 of them are redacted with nothing right. but like black pages. They just keep that. Why even send me that?
Right.
But anyway, that's the way it is. You have
to keep. Do you mm-hmm. include Bob Marley in that as being under surveillance as well?
Excuse me, Davey, I missed that.
Is Bob Marley, you know, is he included in that study?
That's interesting, because I was looking at the recent documentary. They aired it again because of his death May the 11th. And so on May the 11th, they aired that Marley documentary, which is just absolutely tremendous, very, very rewarding. And so, but other Caribbean leaders are included only in as much as they had contact with the U.S. In terms of either teaching here, of course, then Walter Rodney becomes instrumental and very critical to understand his connection, and particularly his political involvements, which were international. He was in Dar. He taught at the University of Dar es Salaam. He was in Tanzania at the time and dealing with the complexities of the Tanzanian government under Julius Nyerere and Ho Ujamaa and what have mm-hmm. you, the Arusha Declaration, those issues. To say nothing of his movement in Guyana and ultimately his assassination there. So Walter Rodney, C.L.R. James, George Padmore, Edward Blyden, these end of George Lamming, all these individuals come into play, but you can't do too much of that because it kind of departs from the basic theme of Malcolm and right. some of his associates and how they were under surveillance too. So you'll see that they're incorporated in there, Kwame Ture, you know, Stokely Carmichael, individuals with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, individuals who were in Grenada even, they come into play, like Don wow. Rojas, my good friend, Don Rojas.
Right.
And I traveled with him quite a bit, going to Haiti and other parts and working with him back in the day, Davey, when you were writing for us with the Black World Today.
Right, right. If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Herb Boyd, longtime journalist, author, talking about the life of Malcolm X. There's so much to cover, but let me just kind of cut to a couple of things that come sure. out. We know that Malcolm meets with all these world leaders. I guess the simple question is, what was the impact? What's the footprint of those meetings that we see, you know, when he sits down with a Nkrumah, you know, mm-hmm. what is the indelible mark from that? What do they kind of talk about? You know, does he share strategies with them and vice versa? And I think we also should just remind people that many of these world leaders are new world leaders. They're not people that's been like, oh, we've been sitting in this position for 20, 30, 40 years. You know, they're still finding their own footing and trying not to be undermined. So, you know, everybody's kind of, in my mind, it's kind of coming of age as they're hitting the world stage.
Exactly. It's a great question because not enough time was remaining in Malcolm's life where he could process those meetings and substance of those conversations. In effect, it was short-circuited. We were cut off from some of the real circumstances and issues that grew out of those conversations because a diary is not that complete. You know, some of it comes forth in terms of what was discussed and some of the visions. And these are visionaries, these individuals getting together and they're concerned about anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism, anti-colonialism, all of those concerns. No matter where Malcolm went, he right. met with leaders who were facing those kind of challenges in terms of the European and U.S. imperialistic grip on their political, economic, and social lives. So those conversations obviously riveted or were resonated around those issues of anti-imperialistic, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist struggle. They had that particular thing in common. Malcolm didn't go anywhere else, although some of these leaders become suspect later on. Mm-hmm. But at the time that they're coming together, they were on a similar path in terms of struggle. And so they could share information. And obviously the U.S., with their surveillance mechanism, they were concerned about making sure there would be disruptive, there no solid contacts between this world leader, this African-American world leader, meeting with these other world leaders. That's where the whole surveillance and the whole CIA yeah. involvement comes into play, is to intercept any kind of consolidation, any kind of meeting of minds, and to be in concert in terms of the mutual enemies that they face and yeah. how we can learn from each other. And I think that was the essential thing about Malcolm, that he was always interested in studying the individuals who were struggling against the same kind of racism and discrimination and domination, the downtrodden, the marginalized. He was interested in those kind of struggles because it would add to what he already had understood in a very personal way in right. his struggles in America.
No, it's fascinating just to think about, you know, the context in which all this exists. And, you know, I'm glad that we have you on as we kind of wrap things up because, sure. you know, this is a reminder of where he was going. And I think the new frontier of divisiveness is to have these new formations and this ideology of, we don't need to know about these Caribbean folks. We don't need to know about these African folks, that whole kind of ADOS type of mindset, or we're just focusing on us, seems to be a different type of divisiveness where we don't really study deeply the entrenched agenda of the, you know, of the United States and all its operatives to keep us, you know, forever divided. And you know, one would wonder where Malcolm would be at this, if he was still alive, what sort of impact he would have had, you know, how much solidarity would we have had with these struggles? Because just looking at the book, you know, he's like, you know, we're talking about just a continent, but even just how he's navigating through the Muslim world itself is a whole other thing that we can have a full-on conversation, because he's connecting those dots in a very important way as well.
And that is absolutely essential and crucial, Davey, and because you make a very insightful argument in that behalf, because the whole Muslim world, the Arab countries, these leaders that he's contacting, seemingly giving him all kind of support, almost to the point where if you, for example, you look at Faisal, Prince Faisal, in terms of opening up his country, opening up, matter of fact, you can take my stateroom, you can take my bedroom, you can take my the whole floor. Where, so he's given all kinds of opportunities, you know, to study in the Arab world. And I think sometimes you can see Malcolm grappling with the religion, grappling with the language, grappling with the culture, trying to digest, even from a standpoint of cuisine, trying to understand exactly how to exist within this here very, very different culture. So that's another challenge. But I always say that, you know, past is prologue. And the divisiveness of that time continues today. Yeah. I think where Malcolm would be today would be, it's probably amazing as he was accumulating information. Yeah, keep in mind that he, like Dr. King, never made it to 40 years of age.
Yeah, 39.
I mean, I am double their ages, and I'm still trying to unravel the puzzle, the mystery that each of those great leaders left behind. And so I have to just speculate. And I think my supposition is that each of them, they were growing in a very mutual way. I mean, Dr. King and Malcolm, you can see the convergence, the kind of trajectory of their lives coming closer and closer together. It's not to say that they would stand together or be the kind of bookends of what was going on at that time, but certainly there seems to be every indication that there was some accord, some agreement was being reached. Malcolm certainly suggested that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, when you look at it from an individual standpoint, you can see maybe they can't come together. But if you're looking at it from the lens of oppression and how we're impacted by it, and maybe this is the wrong way to define it, but imperialism becomes clear, you know, economic upending becomes clear, you know, unapologetic racism becomes clear. And those same systems hitting other people become clear, I think, both for King and X. And that's where I see that they were going to be able to come together, because they realized, like, damn, we're fighting the same enemy who just manifests their tactics in slightly different ways. You maybe use different names, but, you know, it's still Mr. Jones down the street that we're dealing with. And I think that's where stuff was coming into focus, and more so with King, if anything.
Exactly. I think one of the things that both of these great leaders understood was that the whole divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And that they were in challenging each other and criticizing each other, that was playing right into the hands of the oppressors. And I think, Dr. King, you're absolutely right, because he began to see the conjunction. You know, what was happening militarily, what was happening from the standpoint of economic oppression, what was happening with segregation and racism, with the rise of white supremacy, all these things, you know, which are so current today, was just beginning to kind of blossom, you might say, in the 1960s, early 70s.
And
I think both of them understood, exactly, hey, we got some challenges in front. Let's not be arguing with each other. We got a mutual enemy. Let's stand together on this. And you can see the kind of trajectory of their concerns.
Right. And we should be clear, I don't think they really argued with each other. I think they just were contrasting tactics. And I think that's important to note. Argument means, like, you know, me and you are, you know, we're going at it, but I think it's one like, hey, man, he's turning the other cheek. And the other one is like, well, you know, basically you got to turn the other cheek, because we're trying to shame the United States by bringing conflict to us, et cetera, et cetera. King had a strategy behind that. And, it's good to know that in later years that there, you know, at least Malcolm was supportive, you know, like nobody talked about the fact that he went to the March on Washington. you know, that he stayed in the back room and was there and was supportive, even if he was, you know, publicly against the tactic, if you will. And mm-hmm. so those types of things, I think, and I bring them up because they should serve as a model for other folks that, yeah, you may disagree in terms of tactics, but you don't have to be so disruptive that you undermine, you know, the types of steps that people were taking. He seemed more like, okay, let it play out. I'm not going to interfere. It ain't my thing, but, you know, I'm going to be there to help support. That's how I always viewed Malcolm in that type of role. And King, I don't know if he was afforded that because, you know, he did have those political connections mm-hmm. that were pretty clear that they didn't like the nation. They didn't like Malcolm. They didn't like any of that talk. And he was able to curry favor because Malcolm was the alternative. And I think King knew that. It's like, hey, man, if I play this game, you'll give us Voting Rights Act, or you got to talk with these militant guys over here. But you tell me, because you're in the scene, you know, is that how it kind of works?
Well, you certainly, I think what you're suggesting here is that, first of all, there were differences. They had differences. It's okay. Not to say that they were so sharply opposed, but they understand that Malcolm had some concerns about the power and influence of the Big Six.
Yeah.
And he chastised them consistently. What we're seeing is that gradually he steps back from that kind of giving energy and any kind of excess attention to the Big Six and say, well, I'm not going to be talking about that anymore. Let's move on. You know, right. So that means that the Roy Wilkins and the Whitney Youngs and the Dr. Kings and the A. Philip Randolphs, he says, hey, let's forget about that. And it's indicated when he meets with Coretta Scott King and down in Selma.
Right.
And at this time when Dr. King is in jail, so this is getting toward the end of Malcolm's life, where he speaks at the Brown Memorial Church down there to the young people and everything that's captured, mm-hmm. indicating again, telling Coretta Scott King, and I guess the documentaries and the films, or the best of the films, capture those moments when Malcolm is assuring her, you tell Dr. King that we got his back. And so that begins to kind of end the attack. Dr. King had already stepped away from that. I mean, 1967, and in the speech he gave at Riverside Church up here, mm-hmm. was very clear how he felt about what was going on in the war in Vietnam. So he had this international perspective that was sharpening where Malcolm had been for years. But so King, that's what he's saying, Dale, how these things are coming together.
Mm-hmm. But King had to be pushed to that, though, right? He gets pushed to it through SNCC, if I'm correct. And,
oh, no doubt about it. Yeah, that's part of his growing right. how he's being more and more politicized.
Mm-hmm. Right. And SNCC is, you know, they're more, you know, they're embracing Malcolm, right? He goes to speak to them in Selma. So King, I think my point is that King was embracing Malcolm's philosophy, even if it came from yeah. different perspectives. He had to see it that way, not the other way around.
Exactly. They begin to share and have some kind of mutual understanding of that. Hey, we got a more in common than our differences. And I think that's something that's the greatest lesson we can learn, because historically, we've had these very prominent thinkers in our culture and the evolution of our society, going all the way back when you start talking about W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, and when you go Paul Robeson, when you talk about these individuals who came along at a time and trying to grapple with the issues that they faced and the strategies that they proposed, the theories that they announced, you know, all those different kind of things come into play. So we have to have a historical perspective. And I think Malcolm was certainly, and Dr. King, they understood these things. They looked at it and say, okay, fine, we got our differences, but I think we have a mutual concern here as we move forward. Unfortunately, both of them never had a chance to put that into practice. You know, yeah. we can propose all kind of, you know, theories about where they were going and where they might be today. And that's absolutely, you know, try to do that. I don't know how much we can gain from that, but obviously it's an exercise, sometimes in futility. But yeah. Nonetheless, you know, people do that, and books are made, and documentaries right. and films are made on speculation.
Yeah, well, that's why it's important to know the history. Otherwise, you know, you'll have, as we saw, Malcolm sitting right next to Barack Obama. Yeah. And you know, and then you got to go, well, no, I mean, they may have sat each other at a dais if they were invited, but they have very mm-hmm. different political understandings of the world. You know,
indeed.
You know, that would have been reflected in known policies and statements. And so, yeah, you know, people will take liberties. And so that's why you kind of go through some of this exercise of at least trying to unearth what they were about.
That's important, because I'm just concluding looking at term papers now. Each for the last 15 years, and elsewhere, I've been teaching the life and legacy of Malcolm X, most notably here at City College, and my students are turning in their papers now. I have to have my grades in by the 24th of this month.
Right.
And what I did, Davey, and each semester, I challenged myself, because it's very easy to go, hey, you read the autobiography and we go by chapter, you know, 14 weeks, each week we take a chapter. I did that in the beginning, way back in 1967 at Wayne mm-hmm. State University.
Right.
But since then, I've tried different kind of perspectives, how we can go at Malcolm's life and legacy in different, more challenging and interesting ways for the instructor who may be bored with using the same kind of syllabus
right,
over and over again. So what I've been doing over the last two semesters, and I think this may be my last semester, may step away from this because I'm so many difficulties with the pandemic and distance learning and
right.
in-person stuff being absolutely demolished. So I had them look at the trial transcript, which is 5,000 pages.
Wow.
In two semesters, I've divided it up. So now I've got through six volumes that the archives made available. And George Brightman and Herman Porter, in their book, The Assassination of Malcolm X, is a kind of a good way to begin to understand the trial of these three individuals who were charged with that and some of the ramifications of that as it moves into different organizations, different individuals, certainly the Nation of Islam, and a kind of ongoing argument among scholars today, the role of the government, the role of NOI, the role of some other governmental forces in the elimination of Malcolm X. But one of the things about that, the more they do that, the more they keep him on the pages, keep him in yeah. front of us, keep his memory living. And that's right. the most important thing. And that's what I try to instill with my students, is that we studying the trial, but it's a look and read those, each section that you're given, and each of right. them are given like 50 pages. And through two semesters, we're able to go through the whole time. Obviously, the students are, I need a graduate course to make this real in
yeah.
terms of looking at the examination of that trial transcript and with some analysis. But I think it's a step in, maybe some other scholars, some other teachers
right.
come along and go back and look at that trial and see what it was all about.
Well, the other thing that keeps alive, Herb Boyd, is the surveillance state. You know, mm-hmm. and I always remind people it's important to know about the Audubon Ballroom. You know, I know about the Audubon because it was a place where early hip hop parties were thrown, you know, mm-hmm. and it was always just kind of a weird thing to be like, damn, this is where Malcolm died. And this is the birth, you know, one of the birthing places for this culture that is all around the world. But the other thing is that I was born at the Presbyterian. And so, you know, so I always tell people, it's like, hey, man, that the Audubon and the Presbyterian emergency entrance is like literally 300 feet away. It's like right across the street. Like you could, exactly. I mean, it is literally across the street. And how Malcolm was not taken into that entrance for 45 minutes should say it all, you know? And if people don't know that, then they're missing the whole thing. Like, you got to show them the picture. Like, there's the Autobahn. Look right there. There's the entrance. There's the emergency mm-hmm. entrance.
Right. Like,
doctors could have ran out or you could have ran to them, but you didn't for 45 minutes. And that, I think, should be sobering and should be, you know, I'd like to see a trial with the police officers that were on the scene that day. Why did you get him across the street?
But there's so many questions be raised, and some of my students yeah. have done a good job on that. I mean, trying to understand the whole lack of police being there, whether Malcolm had something, what was happening in Malcolm's mind at that time, if he knew he was on the verge of being assassinated, why would you have your wife and your children there? I mean, so many questions are raised about who was on trial and some individuals who were never called to testify.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to the weapons? You know, what happened to certain evidence, you know, and exculpatory stuff that was just not considered at all in terms of the innocence of the three. What about the other four individuals who one of them testified when you talk about Talmadge Harry or Thomas Hagen, saying that the other two individuals, you know, Thomas 15X Johnson and Norman 3X Butler, had nothing at all to do with it.
Right.
So it raises so many questions about this, but my students are grappling with that, and they're doing a pretty good job so far. I got about 12 to 15 more papers to read, and maybe all that adds to, you know, the next generation understanding exactly the importance, how significant this one individual's life was in our overall understanding of a struggle for self-determination in this country.
And the fear that it inspired amongst people trying to hold power.
Indeed.
You know, Dr. Herb Boyd, thank you so much.
Oh, okay, Presbyterian-born David B.
How can people get a hold of you or follow your work?
Oh, you certainly, they can go online. It's just like the CIA and the FBI. Everything about me is in plain view. As
okay.
Malcolm said, make it plain. Just go ahead and, as they say, Google me and you got me.
There you go. Herb Boyd, we appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Davey.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
From frontline struggles to the people who shine, we break it down with a culture in mind. True to the people everywhere we go. Truth to power, we let know. True to the people everywhere we go. Truth to power, we let know.
Hard knock rocking on your radio.
Let's go, y'all. Let's go.